At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Copyright, Glassnote and Farage. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
Did you enjoy the heatwave?
The heatwave?
I'm going to predict that it is now done.
I'm pretty sure...
Basically winter now.
...that meteorologists would disagree with you. I say this based on what my dad told me a few days ago.
Is your dad a meteorologist?
No, but he does watch...
End of conversation.
He watches the weather.
What?
Every single weather bulletin that there is on the British Broadcasting Corporation and occasionally ITV, he watches. So, although he's...
Mate, I've got the Met Office app on my phone, so...
And he seemed to think...
There's a yellow weather warning for thunderstorms tomorrow.
That doesn't mean the heatwave's going
away. By the time people listen to this, that'll be last Friday, and you'll know whether there were thunderstorms or not. It'll be exciting for us to find out and for people to confirm or deny.
But he said it was going to go cooler this week, but then hot again next week.
Well,
by the time this podcast goes out, it was cooler last week, which we can confirm it was. But it may be hot again. So by the time people listen to this podcast, assuming they are listening in this United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, because if they're listening anywhere else, then us chatting about the weather is not only tedious, it's also irrelevant.
I mean, the tedious bit might apply to other people too.
Whereas...
In the UK.
I forgot what I was saying now. Let's stop talking about
your
the weather.
Your dad's an amateur weatherman and reckons he's got it pegged.
And
that's what you're saying.
And you're wrong. The heatwave's here to stay.
I know. We're in for a hot weekend. I know this because I've got the Met Office app on my phone.
And probably a hot week to follow the hot weekend, so that by the time this podcast lands, it will still be hot. I work quite a lot from home.
Yes.
In a loft.
Mm.
And it gets quite hot in the loft because the sun is sort of pounding down. It faces south. Oh, that's a bad idea, isn't it? So the sun pounds down and it got very hot. And during last week when it was very hot in London, I snapped and I bought the most expensive fan in the world.
Is it a Dyson?
It is a Dyson.
Oh, and you're a fancy man.
I spent 2 days agonising over whether this incredibly extravagant fan was a good use of money or not. Also, for that price, you could actually get a little air conditioning unit, but then air conditioning units are pain because you've got to have a pipe going out the window and then noisy.
And then having the window open sort of negates
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't want an aircon unit, and I agonised for 2 days.
And also, when we did have an office and an air conditioning unit, it just meant that all the grime from Shoreditch High Street came in and landed on our desks.
Yeah, none of that in Leytonstone. It's lovely in Leytonstone. But
Shoreditch is disgusting. I'm sure Leytonstone's lovely.
After 2 days of agonising, it was like, well, if I'm going to buy this freaking fan, I better buy it now, otherwise by the time I buy it... The heat wave will be over. So I do now have the most expensive fan in the world near my desk, cooling me down as I write my CMU stories.
I have a very powerful fan that I got for free from somewhere.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
But not a Dyson.
I mean, I think it would probably be less than £20 to buy new. It's probably as good as your Dyson, if not better.
No, my Dyson's brilliant. Although, whether or not it was that brilliant, given how much it cost, I'm still to decide. But it is very good. It is very much the sort of the Apple Mac of fans. I mean, even the little button is an Apple-style button. And the way everything's set up, I mean, I'm surprised Apple haven't sued. I mean, they probably have, because I don't particularly follow design law and patent cases. Somewhere there probably is, because it is sort of like the iPod of fans. But the other thing that yep. I've spent the last... Because we should acknowledge the fact that we've not recorded a podcast now for 3 weeks or something like that.
It's been ages, yeah. That's why we're catching up on all this important stuff.
Because we had those special editions because you went on holiday.
Yeah.
Let's note why that was
the week
was
before that was your fault, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I can't believe it was. And the other thing I've been doing, other than being hot, talking to my dad about the weather and agonising over buying incredibly expensive fans, is I spent most of the rest of the 3 weeks trying to get in touch with the Intellectual Property Office. It's very hard getting in touch with the Intellectual Property Office. That's not true. Their switchboard is really easy to get through to. But if you are a journalist with a media query, they are very hard to get through to. because while you were away, so you won't know this, the IPO put out a report about piracy levels in the UK.
I genuinely didn't know this.
So a report came out while you were away on piracy levels in the UK based on a survey that they do every year at the start of the year. So it's the first quarter of 2018. And piracy levels are pretty much static, but slightly down among young people.
Oh, I did hear that somewhere.
And of course, young people are traditionally the problem. So that's interesting. But at the top of the report, it said that 25% of British consumers were continuing to access content from illegal sources.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately below that was a table that said that 15% of consumers regularly access content from illegal sources. So that confused me.
Yeah.
What has happened between the bullet point here and the table here, like an inch apart from each other, that makes you go from 25 to 15? So I thought, I'm a journalist, I should ask. And so...
Does that happen often?
Occasionally. By this point, I was being cooled by my Dyson fans.
Right.
So I was in for some full-on journalism. So I thought, I'll phone them up and I'll ask them. So there wasn't any press contact on the press release.
Yep. Well, of course, why would there be?
I don't know why. I don't think we'd been emailed the press release. I think it had come up on the feed and it was on their website. But anyway, there was no press contact. But I thought, aha, I know what to do. I'm a journalist. I'll go to the IPO website and I'll click on media queries.
Yeah.
And I'll phone
reasonable.
Phone the phone number. So I went to the Intellectual Property Office's website. I clicked on media queries. There were two phone numbers.
Wow, options.
So I phoned both of them.
At the same time?
Not at the same time. I phoned one of them first. That was number unobtainable. So I tried the second number.
Mm-hmm.
That was number unobtainable.
Good stuff.
The next, it said, out of office hours, you can call, because the IPO reports into the Department of Business, blah, I can't remember what the full title of the Department of Government is.
Business, Statistics and Jumping.
Not that. But it's the Department of Business, etc., that the Intellectual Property Office sits under. And it said, out of office hours, you can call the Department for Business News Desk on this number. Now, it wasn't out of office hours, because by this point it was like 9:15 or 9:30 or something.
That is well within office hours.
But I thought, well, I'll try that number anyway. So I tried that number, and somebody answered that one. But it was genuinely like I'd woken her up and she was in bed, the woman who answered that phone. Now, it was the out-of-office phone line, so perhaps she knocks off at 9 a.m. and goes to bed, I suppose. If she's on call all night, perhaps that is what happens. But it was so like I'd woken her up and she was so spaced out and just answered the phone, hello? And I said, oh, is that the Department of Business press query line? She's like, what? So anyway, I explained what I wanted to know because she confirmed that she was definitely something to do with government PR, although she didn't seem...
She could have been having a dream and you confused her.
She didn't seem to really know. Anyway, she couldn't help me. She said she would ask someone and get back to me. But I was on a deadline, because I'm a journalist and we have deadlines. And
yeah, we have a deadline for recording this podcast we're rapidly going forward to, but carry on.
Everyone talking about this week's a bit boring. one of them's copyright, so it sort of links in.
Yeah.
We're sort of segueing.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the IPO switchboard,
yep,
which is an 03000 number, but I think it probably goes to Cardiff, because I think most of the IPO are actually in Cardiff. Anyway, a very nice person answered the phone on the switchboard. She was trying to help me, but she couldn't find anybody in the Intellectual Property Office with a press or PR job description who would answer their phone. So she suggested that I email. Now, by this point, I'm very close to my deadline. I don't really want to email, but I thought, I'll email. So she gave me the email address, media queries, for the Intellectual Property Office. So I sent an email with my question. That then bounced. Immediately bounced. So it's like, okay, maybe I'll go to the Department of Business and blah, 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 and see what their media queries webpage says. So that had a different phone number.
Yeah.
So I tried calling that, and I got through to a bloke, and I explained everything I've just explained. Which, as you can imagine, took quite a long time.
And he didn't hang up on you.
He didn't hang up on me, although at the end of it, he did go, what do you want?
I'm wondering similar.
I explained what I wanted, and he was like, I don't know. I'll see if I can find out. And so he said he would email me. I said, can you call me? So I left with both my phone number and my email address. But by this point, A, I was quite close to deadline. B, I had now invested so much time in this story, I wasn't going to drop it. So I took off my journalist hat. I put on my consultant hat. And I emailed one of our clients who I suspected would know somebody quite high up at the Intellectual Property Office. So she did. So she put me in touch with him. He was then very helpful, although didn't really acknowledge my little rant at the start of my email about the fact that none of their phone numbers or email addresses work. But he did answer my question. So well done to him. And then after that, that guy, that slightly blunt guy I'd spoken to in Department of Business, sent me an email saying, sorry, I've not been able to help you with your query. I suggest that you call the Intellectual Property Office media team. Here are their phone numbers. Here are their email addresses. And of course, they were the phone numbers I'd already tried. Yeah. It didn't work. And the email address that bounced. So I spent most of my 3 weeks on the phone to the Intellectual Property Office.
Right.
Do you want to know what the 2515 thing was?
I'd forgotten all about that. Yeah, okay.
So it is 25% of people who access entertainment content online pirate or access some illegal content in the first quarter of 2018. And 15% of all consumers access illegal content, because we forget that there are still some people, and by that maths, quite a few people, who access no music, no movies, no TV, no sport, no ebooks or no software, because those are all the things that were covered by the survey. None of that online. And when you take them into the mix, it is 15% of British consumers who are still accessing content illegally online in 2018. So,
Wow.
It's good to know, given that copyright industries of the UK feel under threat at the moment in Europe, which we're about to talk about, it's good to know that we've got an organised, easily accessible intellectual property office fighting their corner.
Well, as you say, I guess that is relevant to today's conversation, and it was, I don't want to say worthwhile, you telling that story, but you told that story. I'll acknowledge that.
I wouldn't have told
it. You did tell that story.
Had it not been 100% relevant to the first thing we're going to talk about on this week's podcast. In fact, I'm counting it as actually being the first section. The intro finished when we stopped talking about fans, and the first story began when I started talking about my efforts to get in touch with the Intellectual Property Office.
No, because that is not the format of how the show works.
Oh, you're going to say because you didn't have the opportunity to say, coming up on this edition.
Exactly.
Well, do that now, and then in the edit, we'll stick that back at the start of me talking about trying to phone the Intellectual Property Office, and then it'll all be fine.
I don't know. Well, let's see. Let's see what happens. I'm not in control of the edit. Coming up this week, Glassnote's legal battle with Childish Gambino and Rage Against the Machine's legal letter over Nigel Farage's podcast. But first, while we were off, lots went on with the European Copyright Directive, which I believe we talked about last time we did a standard edition of the show, which was 3 weeks ago now. Ultimately, although we were talking about last time the European Parliament waving it all through, they've now voted it all down. It's all gone. Not gone. It's going to go back to a debate in September.
Yeah, by the time this actually happened, it wasn't that big a surprise. And the speed with which some of the music industry's trade bodies issued their statements after the vote had gone through, well, I suppose they had written a statement for both outcomes.
Yes.
But clearly they recognised that they needed to have a statement ready for a bad outcome.
Yes.
So this is the very, very, very long in development European Copyright Directive, which is aiming to reform.
And even longer in development now.
Aiming to reform copyright rules across Europe in relation to Tinternet. And of course, in there, you have Article 13, which is the one that the music industry at large have been campaigning on prolifically. There are some other things in there which are relevant to the music industry too. Article 14, for example. Maybe even Article 15. But it was Article 13, and actually Article 11, which is more to do with newspapers and news providers. It was those two elements of the Copyright Directive that proved very controversial indeed. And I think on the last edition, we were talking about how, whereas it felt, ever since the European Commission started working on this directive, so even before they published the first draft in 2016, it did feel like the music industry, who have been pushing on Article 13. I mean, it is now backed by the wider media and entertainment industry too, but it was really the music industry's initiative that got Article 13, that being the article which is attempting to reform the so-called copyright safe harbour to increase the liabilities of user upload platforms like YouTube. And it was the music industry that got it into the first draft of the directive. And for a time, it looked like it wasn't going to be in there. And they lobbied hard and they got it into the directive. And then there's been so much debate in various committees in the European Parliament since then. But it did feel like, although there were critics and there were opponents to that safe harbour reform, the music industry, backed by the wider entertainment industry, had the edge until a few months ago. And then the tech lobby,
well, even a few weeks. I mean, it was really ramped up as the vote got closer.
Yeah, the tech lobby went into overdrive. And there's been lots of chatter about how many millions and millions and millions of pounds Google have allegedly pumped into this last-minute campaign to kick Article 11 and Article 13 of the European Copyright Directive out of the field.
Yes, although I think actually the point at which I thought this definitely isn't going to go the music industry's way was when I went onto Wikipedia for something and it had a big black bar at the top that said the European Parliament is trying to destroy the internet. Write to your MEP now.
I think in Italy, it actually went completely down, like happened way back when they were talking about introducing web blocking into American copyright law and the English language version of Wikipedia. So therefore, it affected us, even though it wasn't a UK thing. Went dark for the day. You couldn't access Wikipedia for the day in the English language version. And I think the same happened with the Italian version in the run-up to the vote in the European Parliament. So although it felt like initially the music industry had the edge here, as the big vote got closer, the tech lobby went into overdrive. So basically, what had previously happened was that four different committees of the European Parliament had been scrutinising and amending the original draft of the directive that the European Commission had written, including Article 13. The jury committee of the European Parliament, which was the lead committee on this directive, the Legal Affairs Committee, then voted on it, and they voted it through, of course.
Yes.
So they voted
that was where we were last time we discussed this.
So the music industry was very excited about that. We've got it through. But it became very clear very quickly that enough MEPs were going to demand a full vote of Parliament. So everybody there, which isn't necessary unless a certain number of MEPs demand a full vote. But a certain number of MEPs did demand a full vote. So then what happened while we were away was every MEP voted on it, and they voted it down. So whereas it got through Legal Affairs, it didn't get through the entire Parliament. And basically now, everything has been kicked back to September, when there is going to be another debate in Parliament about the bloody European Copyright Directive.
So what happens now?
Well, that's a very good question. What does happen now? So when the Parliament vote happened, and it was quite close in the end, I can't remember the exact, I think it was, there was like 40 votes in it or something. So the will of the people, as some people would say, because there was a slight majority against the European Copyright Directive. But when they voted it down, I spoke to a few people who do European Parliament lobbying stuff. And I said, OK, they're saying we're going to have another debate about the directive in September. How's that going to work? What's going to happen? Will more amendments be proposed before then? What's going to happen? And they were sort of like, we don't really know, because this hardly ever happens. Mm. Usually all the debates happen in committee, the lead committee votes on it, and then either it goes straight on to the next stage, which basically is when the Parliament sits down with the European Commission and the EU Council to negotiate a final version, because there are other people debating this at the same time. Or it goes for a full vote, but the full vote nods it through. So it's sort of unusual. But basically, the entire Parliament will be debating it in September, which I think means any of the 750-odd MEPs can take part in this debate, make amendments to this. I mean, how do you organise that? How do you regulate that? So I don't know. I think when this happens in September, it could be chaos.
Yeah.
But presumably, although in theory everything has been kicked back till September.
I mean, that assumes that every one of those 750-ish people has an opinion on this.
But given how much lobbying there's been going on, actually on both sides, they've certainly got enough email in their inboxes to form an opinion, because everybody has been sending them email. Every Wikipedia user has been sending them an email, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, presumably over the summer break, lots of lobbying will be going on.
I mean, this now seems like... People in the music industry won't thank me for saying this, but the EU has a lot of things to be getting on with at the moment. This now seems like quite a big waste of their time.
We've got to sort out the copyright. I mean, forget the immigration crisis. Forget Brexit screwing everything up. Let's get the copyright sorted out. That's what I say.
Oh, yeah, all right. I guess I see your point. Yeah.
So I don't know. At what point does somebody have to say, let's take out Articles 11 and 13 just to get everything else through? There's so much other stuff to go through. It would be mad to scupper all of that for these two articles. So is there a point at which you just give up on those two and you say, OK, we'll get everything else through and then we'll come back to safe harbour and then we'll come back to the news provider stuff that's in Article 11. We'll do that another day through another directive. Or can the two sides behind the scenes reach some sort of compromise? And it was interesting because on the last edition of Setlist, when we were talking about this, one thing I was saying in criticism of the tech lobbies campaigning and the copyright critics campaigning, with the whole it's the end of memes, it's the end of social media and all of that, and sort of what most of that campaigning was ignoring or failing to explain, was that if you take someone else's photo and make it into a GIF and then distribute that over Twitter or Facebook, in most cases, that's already copyright infringement.
Yes.
The point is that you're liable as the user, but the chances are you're never going to get sued because no one knows who you are. You'd be really hard to find. And anyway, you probably haven't got any money and you only sue rich people. So the copyright infringement is already there. What Article 13 is doing is saying that Twitter, Facebook, YouTube should take some responsibility for the infringement. And where you think that taking someone's photo or music or video and doing something with it shouldn't be copyright infringement, well, there are the copyright exceptions. And we talked about that last time. Your use may be covered by the parody exception or the critical analysis exception, etc. But one of the big things that did come up in the final stages was if the outcome of Article 13 is forcing more and more websites to introduce content ID type systems, so the system that YouTube already has for monitoring and trying to spot copyright infringing material on its platform, if more and more platforms have to implement that kind of technology, is that technology up to the job of being able to spot critical analysis and parody and the uses of content which are legitimate even without a license? Which was something that kind of came up in the Dancing Baby Prince case.
Yes.
In America, although not with any resolution.
No.
They just noted it was an issue. And so that was one of the things that did come up, which is if this Article 13 forces all the social media and user upload platforms to put these filters in place, there is debate on whether or not it would. But if it did, are those filters capable of spotting where content actually has been legitimately used or not? And if they're not, I suppose that's where it almost, well, certainly that is where the critics would come in with their censorship, free speech arguments. So I don't know whether there is a technical solution to that or a legal solution to that, but it will be interesting to see come September whether or not behind the scenes some sort of compromise has been constructed, or whether we will just have 750 different ideas being shouted into the middle of the room and no resolution ever.
Well, I'm going to go with the latter. I think that's probably more likely based on how it's gone so far.
Well, look at you being all pessimistic on safe harbour reform. Well, we will see in September.
That well, will we?
Well, we'll see what's going to happen.
We'll see something in September.
We'll definitely see something in September. And hey, let's touch some wood, because there is actually some wood on the table that sits between me and Andy in this studio. Let's touch some wood that actually, that may well be the last we have to say about this until September.
Oh, God, I hope so.
Unless there is some backroom conversations that then leak. But it may well be no more copyright directive, no more safe harbour, and certainly no more phoning the Intellectual Property Office for clarification on anything before September.
Still to come, Rage Against the Machine against Nigel Farage, and some news in brief. But now, US independent label Glassnote Records has sued Childish Gambino, aka Donald Glover, in a dispute over what should happen to royalties that are earned from his recordings but are paid to the collecting society Sound Exchange.
So Glover, I think we'll call him Glover, or Donald, for the purposes of the podcast this week.
I don't want to call him Childish.
Although,
or Gambino.
You could argue that some of this is quite childish. But given we're talking about litigation here, and in the litigation, they definitely call him Donald and Glover.
And that is his name.
That is his name. So let's talk about Donald Glover. He released 3 albums with Glassnote Records. Mm-hmm. So obviously he has various sides to his career.
Yes.
But Glassnote were quite actively involved in launching.
I mean, have you watched Atlanta?
I haven't, no.
It's on the iPlayer. It's really good. You should watch it.
Well, I will.
Sorry, anyway, that was an aside. We haven't got time.
We do not have time because of all that waffle you had earlier about the Intellectual Property Office, which threw us off schedule. But anyway, as I was saying, Glassnote were quite actively involved in launching the music side of Donald Glover's career.
Yes.
He was signed to them and they released 3 albums, but he parted company with them late last year. And then earlier this year, his management company announced an alliance with Sony Music. And Sony are going to be working with his management company on releasing the next album.
His last as Childish Gambino, so we will be able to call him Donald Glover without concern.
Without having to explain or justify.
Unless he takes another stage name.
Which he may well do.
He might. I mean, no, just...
Grown up Gambino.
Just keep all your things under one name, that's what I say. Sorry, that was another aside.
It is another aside, and there ain't
no time for
asides. And although...
Atlanta is very good, though.
There was a little bit of tension between Donald Glover and Glassnote while they were still working with each other. He dissed them a few times on the social networks, if I remember rightly. But it does seem like that they worked together perfectly fine until the end of last year. Then he said, OK, I'm not going to work with Glassnote on my future stuff. I'm going to do a deal with Sony. And then since then, there have been some disputes. And the main dispute, and the one which is now subject to legal action, is over what should have happened over the last several years for these free albums when money is collected in America by the collecting society Sound Exchange.
Quickly, like really quickly, super, super, super quickly, explain how that works.
How Sound Exchange works. Yeah. There is, in America, a compulsory license for online and satellite radio, and the online radio bit includes personalized radio services like Pandora and iHeartRadio. So anybody running a satellite radio station, so that's basically Sirius, or any sort of online radio station, whether that's a normal DJs playing music type radio station or something a little bit more sophisticated like Pandora, if they wish, those organisations can get a licence through this organisation called Sound Exchange, which is a collecting society, and the music industry is obliged to allow those services to access their recordings and pay royalties through this organisation. And when that happens, so this is Sirius, it's online radio. With Pandora and iHeart now, it's a little bit more complicated because actually there's quite a few direct deals being done between labels and Pandora and iHeart. But when the money flows through Sound Exchange, the way it works, which actually mirrors what happens when money flows through PPL, which is the Record Industries Collecting Society here in the UK and sort of the closest similar organisation over here. So the system's basically the same, which is whenever money flows through Sound Exchange, it gets split and 50% gets paid to the copyright owner, which will usually be a label or a distributor. And 50% is paid directly to the performers, so the money never goes through the label's bank account. And of the 50% that goes to the performers, well, of that 50%, 10%, so that's 5% overall. Are you following the maths?
Right, yeah.
5% overall gets paid to the session musicians, and that gets paid through an organisation that was set up by the trade unions for session musicians in America. And then the 45% goes to the featured artist. So that is how it works, which means that while Donald Glover has been releasing these records with Glassnote, whenever those records or tracks off those records were played by Sirius or Pandora or any other radio service under these licenses, the money would have gone into Sound Exchange, which then would have immediately paid 50% over to Glassnote, who aren't technically the copyright owner because their record deal with Donald Glover was a licensing deal. Mm-hmm. However, they basically had the license to represent pretty much all of the rights in the copyright. So Glassnote would have been getting the copyright owner, the label share, and then 45% of the money would have been paid directly to Glover, and then 5% would have gone to session musicians through the system.
Well, that all seems quite simple. So what's the issue?
The issue is that Donald Glover's people turned round to Glassnote and said, we've had a good think about this. And even though we've been working together for years, and that's how it's been going for years, we've had a big think about it, and we think that all of the Sound Exchange money, minus the 5% that the session musicians can have, they can have their 5%. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, the rest of it should have been going directly to Donald. Glassnote shouldn't have been taking their 50%. And therefore, they reckon that Glassnote should hand over $1.5 million to make up for all the royalties that should have gone to Donald, which have gone to Glassnote, even though I'm pretty sure, by my reading of the lawsuit, about $700,000 has gone to Glassnote under Sound Exchange. So I don't quite know where the $1.5 million comes from. But anyway, what happened is Donald Glover's people said to Glassnote, we think you got it wrong on the Sound Exchange royalties, but we think you owe us $1.5 million. And if you don't pay us that by a certain date in July, we will sue you.
Yeah, so this has clearly been going on behind the scenes for a while. And now that date in July has arrived. Clearly, both sides have been very firm on them being in the right on this. So Glassnote say, no, that money's ours. And Donald Glover's people say, no, that money's his. So Glassnote have preempted any legal action by the Donald Glover side by filing their own legal action, basically asking a court to confirm that their contracts say that they should have that 50% of the Sound Exchange money. And it's sort of the way they worded it as well is a bit like, well, clearly he's not happy with the $10 million we've already made for him, and now he wants a bit more money from us.
It was quite interesting because TMZ reported on this story, and they reported it very much, well, like they do. And they basically said, oh, this label reckons that Childish Gambino has screwed them out of some money, and they were sort of heightening it up. And then Glassnote put out a statement saying, that's not what's happening. We're not saying he screwed us out of any money. We're just saying that we should be able to keep this sound exchange money because that's what copyright law and our contract says. So they were trying to play down the dispute. But then the wording of their court filing, the papers that they submitted to court, I mean, they were quite harsh, as you say, in basically saying, we helped launch his career. We made all the investment. It was a 50-50 licensing deal, which obviously is a pretty decent deal if the label is investing lots of upfront money and marketing and stuff. And then you're right. They said, we've already paid this guy $8 million. We've got $2 million sitting ready to pay for him on his next royalty statement. He's already received about $700,000 directly from Sound Exchange for his performer's share. And it's like, yeah. And now he wants more money. So yeah, Glassnote's legal filing was quite harsh, even though they were subsequently trying to play down the drama of the dispute.
It's a bit of a flip of the traditional record industry bitterness. The label calling the artist greedy. I mean, that's not usually how it goes. It is usually the other way around, but they didn't actually accuse him of being greedy for the issue of statement about that. But that is how it came across in their lawsuit.
Yeah, it was very easy, certainly, to infer that they were calling him a little bit greedy, even if that wasn't what they meant to imply. It will be interesting to see if Donald Glover's side respond to this lawsuit or indeed file their own countersuit in some way. Because I have to say, having read the Glassnote lawsuit, I mean, obviously, I've not seen the full contract between Glassnote and Donald Glover. They quote bits of it in the lawsuit, but I've not seen the full contract. But to be fair to the label, what they're saying is the way it works is the way it works.
Yes.
So they are correct in describing how it normally works. So I would think...
There would have to be some weird quirk of the contract that we're missing.
I think so. I mean, I don't know if they're saying, well, the law says that the copyright owner gets half the money. And technically, because this was a licensing deal between Donald Glover and Glassnote and not an assignment deal, Donald Glover is the copyright owner who is then just licensed over all the rights. Of So I don't know if there's something around that that they're going to bring up, or whether there is a specific clause in the contract we don't know about, or whether they don't really understand, or they're trying. I don't know.
I mean, if that is what they're saying, it's a licensing deal, so Glassnote isn't the copyright holder. I mean, the licensing deals are increasingly prevalent. I mean, if that went in Donald Glover's favour, that would have quite big implications across a lot of deals.
Yeah, if that is their argument, this becomes a really, really interesting case.
Yeah.
Because you're right, if that is their argument and they did win, that would set a massive precedent that would mean all of the Sound Exchange money that's been going to the labels, they would have to go through all of the deals, and wherever it was a licensing deal rather than an assignment deal, the labels would have to hand that money over. So I would say we're speculating here, and then we're speculating on our speculating. We shouldn't do that, but it will be interesting to see how they respond. And if that is how they respond, this will become a very fascinating case indeed.
Just quickly, time now for some news in brief. A US appeals court has declined to reconsider the controversial Blurred Lines judgment.
Yeah, still rumbling its way through the system.
And almost rumbled. They've only got one more option left.
Yeah, Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke could take the case to US Supreme Court in their ongoing dispute with the Marvin Gaye estate. But that is another court ruling that they did indeed rip off Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up on their hit Blurred Lines.
Chinese web firm Tencent has confirmed that it's going to float its music division in the US on the stock market. And US smart speaker maker Sonos has filed to IPO as well.
Yes, on the back of all the excitement around the old Spotify listing, we have two other music-relevant IPOs are likely to happen this year.
Drake played a surprise headline set at Wireless earlier this month now, which was nice, because DJ Khaled had pulled out at the last minute, apparently, although possibly not.
Yeah, it's all a bit confusing, isn't it? So Wireless Festival happened in Finsbury Park in London earlier this month. DJ Khaled and Friends, it was billed, was meant to be headlining. Then at the last minute, they were like, DJ Khaled's pulled out due to travel issues. But don't worry, we've managed to get Drake to do a headline set instead, which was a pretty big thing. Except
at
it turns
short
out
notice.
At such short notice. Except it turned out that the Drake surprise appearance was going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
And it was a sort of a short
mega
mix
30 minutes,
sort of set, because presumably it was going to come before the headline set in the original plan. Also, it did subsequently materialise, because Well, shortly before the festival announced that DJ Khaled was not going to make it due to travel issues, he had been posting photos from his holiday.
Yeah.
In, was it Mexico or Brazil?
Mexico.
Somewhere around there. Mexico. And saying he was having a great time on his holiday. So people are like, well, hang on a second, what are the travels issues? He seems to be on holiday. So then they were all laying in to DJ Khaled on the social networks. So then wireless organisers then sort of backtracked a bit and said, well, actually, we've been aware for some time that there were issues around DJ Khaled appearing because he is involved in some TV project, but we were trying to make it happen. We're really sorry. But it does sort of feel like, well, I don't know, there seems to be a whole story there that we're yet to unravel as to exactly why.
Their statement suggested they'd known, I mean, they said for several months, so it suggested they'd known for quite a while that he probably couldn't do it. But then they hadn't actually announced till the festival was happening that he couldn't do it. But I mean, you know, the fact that he wasn't maliciously posting pictures from his holiday. He was just on holiday and seemingly wasn't aware that he was expected in London at all.
So there could yet be some more fallout of that. I think perhaps they're hoping that the surprise Drake set would have placated enough people that that won't come back to haunt them. But we'll see what happens with that.
We'll see. Find links to all these stories and everything discussed on this week's show at setlistpodcast.com. And finally this week, Rage Against the Machine have sent a cease and desist letter to Nigel Farage. The band wants the former UKIP leader to stop calling his podcast Farage Against the Machine, not least because that pun does not work.
Yeah, it just about works written down, but it's a podcast, so it's an audio product, and it really doesn't work when it is spoken. So this is a podcast that Nigel Farage does for LBC, the London radio station. It launched earlier this year, and actually, at the time it launched, Rage Against the Machine, via a semi-official Twitter account,
I think it's the Twitter account run by, I think I'm right in saying, the guy who set up the Get Rage Against the Machine to Christmas Number One campaign, and then kind of became involved with the band through that, and through the Findlay Park gig that they did to celebrate that at a later date. It's worth mentioning that, because I think that's why it had the particular language that it did at the time. So this Twitter account tweeted about Farage's podcast, "This piss weasel is the machine, peddling the sort of inane, blame-heavy bullshit that the guys in Rage Against the Machine have been raging against since day one."
So that was back when the Nigel Farage podcast first went live. So the news in the last week is that the legal reps of Rage Against the Machine now have apparently, this is according to gossip site The Blast, who have seemingly seen this letter, have sent a letter to Nigel Farage and LBC.
A letter that basically says what that tweet said, but without the word piss weasel. It's a shame, really.
Basically saying that stop using our name in your podcast name, even in a really sort of silly, punny thing that doesn't really work, because your politics is X, our politics is Y. They are clearly diametrically opposed. We do not want to be associated with what you're doing. They also talk a little bit, don't they, about how Farage is the machine, and so sort of setting himself up as being this sort of anti-establishment figure when actually he is part of that machine himself.
Yes, well, I mean, as I say, the title doesn't work at all. I mean, it's poorly conceived from the outset. So Rage Against the Machine's letter goes on to say that Farage's podcast brazenly and unlawfully exploits our client's name and logo, then demands that he completely stop using the Farage Against the Machine name, and says that it falsely associates him and his colleagues at LBC and his far-right political views with Rage Against the Machine. That's a lot of things associated with a band that they don't want to be associated with.
Understandably so. Now, the exact legal...
Especially LBC.
The exact legal basis for demanding that Nigel Farage stop calling his podcast Farage Against the Machine, I don't actually know, because potentially it could be a trademark thing, because also Nigel Farage would probably say it's a parody, but parody doesn't really apply to trademarks in the way that it does for copyright. Except, I did check this, I did some more journalism this week. I've been very busy with my proper research this week. I checked the trademark registry in both the UK and the US, and as far as I can see, when it comes to the trademark Rage Against the Machine, the band did register it in both the UK and the US in the early 90s. But although trademarks in theory last forever, providing you continue to use them, you do have to refile paperwork. In the UK, it's every 10 years. I think it's probably the same in the US as well. And as far as I can see, they haven't filed that paperwork. So both the UK trademark registry and the US trademark registry declare that trademark as being dead, is the legal term that they use. So therefore, I don't think there probably is a case under trademark. Then you sort of get into, okay, what else could there be that the lawyers of Rage Against the Machine in the US reckon that this is in some way infringing the band's rights. Of course, could be done under American law, even though it's a British podcast, because the podcast is obviously available online and therefore in America. So I don't know exactly what the precise legal arguments would be. Although, if it sort of became like a passing off case where you're basically saying people might think that this podcast is somehow linked to or endorsed by the band, and therefore it's damaging the band's reputation, I mean, the only problem with that is, as they state in their own letter, the politics of Nigel Farage and Rage Against Machine are so famously opposed to each other, like at opposite ends of the scale. Certainly in the UK, where everyone knows who Nigel Farage is, I don't think anyone would begin to believe that this podcast was in any way linked to the band. I suppose it's potential in the US, where I don't know how well known is Nigel Farage.
Well,
I
mean, he's on Fox quite a lot, isn't he?
He's on Fox and he's sort of mates with Donald Trump. So I don't know quite what his profile is like over there. But maybe people over there would tune into this podcast and think, hey, is this somehow linked to the band? But certainly over here, I don't think anyone is going to be confused in that way, which would potentially impact on their legal case for blocking Nigel Farage's use of this word. But it does sort of feel like I'm ending this podcast by constructing a case for Nigel Farage's defence. So I think we should end the podcast.
Let's just stop this now.
Before I get too far into that.
Right, well, that's all we've got time for this week then. If you were mentioned in this episode and feel like we should have heaped more praise upon you, as the executive from a company that owns a high street retail chain did of an earlier episode, you can tweet us, SetlistPod. We're also SetlistPod on all the other social media that matter, the ones where I've bothered to set up accounts anyway. And you can email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk as well. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU, presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.